Okay, before we get too far into today's episode, I got some exciting news to share. We've officially launched a website where you'll discover a hub for all things Star Wars. From the latest news to exclusive merchandise. And here's the best part. For just $5 a month, you can join our membership program to access all of our episodes completely ad-free and all new episodes a few days earlier. But that's not all. Our members enjoy a treasure trove of content that'll never hit the airwaves of this show, including special episodes, full audio comics, and books. So if you're craving extra content or eager to listen to an episode early without interruptions or simply just want to grab a Sway t-shirt, head over to www.swaypodcast.com. That's SWAAPODCAST.com. Don't miss out on your chance for exclusive content and so much more.
What role do you have?
You are now tuned in to Talk to Sway. So just sat back and I'm ready to play. Let me take your thoughts far, far away. Now let's hear what Darth Vader has to say.
We would be honored if you would join us.
What's going on, Star Wars Explorers? This is Kyle coming at you from the most epic Star Wars show on the web, Star Wars Audio Archives. And today, we're diving into part 3 of Into the Dark. Now, if you thought what we've seen so far was wild, you ain't seen nothing yet. We're about to get into some seriously crazy adventures, where our heroes got to deal with all kind of wild stuff, like figuring out who's a friend and who is a foe, and facing challenges that are super intense. So get ready to jump back into the action. Grab your snacks, find a comfy spot, and let's get lost in the galaxy far, far away together. Are you ready? Then let's go.
Reeth wouldn't have been concerned for even a moment if they'd been stranded in space in the Republic. Long beams always flew stocked with surplus fuel and provisions for journeys 2 or 3 times as long as scheduled. The surpluses were unnecessary, of course. Abundant hyperspace traffic and a subspace transceiver meant that a potential rescue ship was rarely more than a few hours away. Out on the frontier, however, it seemed possible to be stranded for very long periods of time, maybe permanently. So Affy's announcement had at first sent a wave of grateful relief washing over Reeth. Someone needed help. They might be able to give it, which would lend this strange detour some meaning. But Orla's words had stopped him, hand halfway to the holo transceiver switch. He couldn't believe he'd been on the verge of trusting the frontier. Affy had obviously gotten there even before Orla's warning. What if they're pirates? What if they're Nihil? What if they're just desperate people who'd raid us for food? I'm sorry, Reeth said, apologizing for the mistake he'd nearly made. These aren't risks we have to deal with very often in the Republic. Leox Jossi eased around Orla and strolled back onto the bridge, clearly having overheard much of this. That's about the first good thing I've heard about our joining the Republic, he said. Makes me reconsider my reservations, and I sincerely appreciate any chance to look within. But this ain't the Republic yet, my man. Not by a long shot. Master Jorah's voice echoed in Reeth's head. Whenever you feel foolish, remember that you have been given an opportunity to learn. The truly foolish act is to refuse that opportunity. All right, pirates I know about. But the Nihil? Who are they? Good question, Orla said. She remained still and quiet at the door, though the tension Reeth sensed within her seemed to arise from something other than their current situation. Leox and Affy shared a glance that somehow seemed to include Geode, despite Geode's notable lack of eyes.
They rose up a few years ago, Affy said. I mean, they've been around longer, but they just recently became dangerous. Nobody's sure where they're from.
Nor can we determine their ethos, Leox added. A confounding people. But we know 3 things for sure. They're raiders, they're brutal, and they're not out there right now.
It was Affy and Reeth's turn to share a glance. Reeth said, How do you know it's not them out there?
I know it because we're still alive. Leox took his seat. Doesn't mean we couldn't have some trouble, though. Tell you what, you pull the head monk or whatever in here, and we'll go through the signals together. See if we've got help, or need to give help,
or should absent ourselves post-haste. We'll go get Komak, Orla said, already turning to leave. Wreath scrambled to catch up with her, thinking Master Jorah couldn't have known about any of this, or she'd never have brought us out here. As soon as Wreath and Orla were gone, Affy turned to Leox.
Since when do we need Jedi to help us decide what's dangerous and what's not? Especially since they've never even heard of the Nihil.
We don't need them for that, Leox said. But we three need to have a quick talk without any Republic types present.
Affy realized what he had to be referring to almost instantly. She leaned in as Leox put one arm around her shoulders and one around Geode.
Here's the situation, Leox said. We would, of course, never want our Jedi to think that they might be aboard a ship carrying some cargo that is not, in the strictest sense, legal in the Republic.
Never, Affy said, straight-faced. That would never happen. The Jedi don't know anything that would make them think that.
Leox nodded. We'd be prudent to keep it that way. Which is why, no matter who's out there, or what they want, or what they might pay, we continue to present ourselves as an absolutely open ship. A hauler-turned passenger transport just for the one ride.
Affy added, no matter who comes on board or where they want to search, certain compartments should continue not to exist.
So very true.
Leox pulled back.
Remember, everybody, our perceptions define the reality of the universe. Nothing is even a thing until our thinking makes it so.
Not thinking about those compartments, Affy said. The ones that aren't there.
Scover's gonna be so proud of you.
Leox smiled at her. Affy could have hugged him, not for the praise, but for his casual assumption that her mother was still alive. There was, of course, no head monk among the Jedi party. However, Komak Vidus had the most field experience of the group, and he could tell that Orla was shaken. They would need to talk about it soon. The parallels between this mission and the first they ever undertook together. But there would be time for that later. The distress call demanded his attention, so he went with Wreath back to the bridge to help sort through the various signals.
Why not in the comm center?
Komak said, instead of hello. Leox Jossi did not seem the sort to stand on ceremony.
First, because we're not talking back just yet, Leox replied. So we only need to isolate and analyze the signals right now. Second, because we can get a much better bead on each signal's origin from up here.
Logical,
Komak said approvingly. How rare to find a freelance pilot who operated on a rational basis, even if he looked and talked like this one. How steadying to have a problem that demanded concrete solutions, one that required him to search beyond their ship for answers instead of looking within.
How many are we picking up in the immediate sector?
Looks like 11,
Affy said, gesturing to various red blinking dots on a green grid.
Of those, 6 are standard cargo haulers, not that different from us, except none is guild registered. Another 2 are standard passenger haulers, ranging in size from 5-person skiffs to...
She whistled.
To at least one with 200 sentients on board.
Many people needed help then. Possibly soon. Komak felt re-energized with purpose. Already he'd been itching to do something, anything of use. It appeared that he would be called upon even sooner than he'd hoped. The Jedi's mission at the frontier would begin with both mercy and strength. First, however...
What about the others?
What about that one? Wreath asked, pointing over Affy's shoulder. The bigger one. Some of those readings... Those are high radiation levels, right?
Leox nodded, but his lack of concern was so complete that it nearly operated as a tranquilizer. Looks like Mizzy to me. They're not as susceptible to radiation as most sentient species, so they haul cargo a lot of other ships can't. And that one there? He pointed to the next to last dot on the screen. That looks Orinkan, which is bad news. Their lack of outer beauty is perfectly matched by their lack of inner beauty. I hate to be disparaging of an entire species, but if there are any Orinkans overflowing with wit, charm, and kindness, I've yet to make their acquaintance. Colmac asked, "What about the final ship?" "That's the one that bothers me." Leox zoomed in until the specs for that particular ship, the farthest out, became clear. "Smallest of the lot. The one that sent the original signal we intercepted. But I can't make heads or tails of it." Colmac could see the difficulty. "The engines of a racer, the plating of a transport, sensor strength almost akin to a research vessel, and yet some of the components are weak."
"Old, to judge by the readings," Affy said. "So they've souped up some of their systems, but ignored the others until they're almost falling apart. Which is weird, right?"
"Yes, but hardly unique." Colmac considered the possibilities. No armaments showed up on scans. Armaments could be shielded with certain plating. However, the engines didn't seem powerful enough to support that kind of shielding. He weighed the possibilities and decided.
"Let's contact them directly."
"But if they're pirates..."
Affy began, then stopped when Leox shook his head.
"You saw their scanners," he said. "They know we're here. They know what we're about. If they want to attack, they're gonna. So far they haven't. It's worth a shot. You want to make the call, Power Man?"
It took Wraith a moment to make the connection. Colmac concealed his amusement.
It's Padawan, actually. But I can make the call."
He stepped closer to the comms and flipped the toggle.
"This is the vessel, vessel. What's your designation? Can you transmit a visual signal? Over."
The screen fuzzed, then clarified into the image of a young girl, younger even than Wraith Silas and Affy Hollow, though Colmac thought only by a year or so. Her shining dark hair was pulled back into a neat tail, and her rounded cheeks blushed as she smiled.
"Oh, thank goodness. We were so scared you might be pirates. But you don't look like pirates. Wait, are you pirates?"
Wraith was smiling too, as were most of the other people on the bridge.
"Not pirates. Travelers bound for Starlight Beacon and now stranded here."
"At least we're not the only ones,"
said the young girl.
"I'm calm now. It's just me and my guardian out here, and we don't have much."
Colmac interjected.
"Some of us, including Wraith here and myself, are Jedi, sworn to protect and defend the peoples of the Republic."
All peoples, really, but he wanted them to understand the good that the Republic could bring to their lives.
"We'll contact all the ships in short order, work on organizing together. Sharing resources will be the best way to survive this crisis."
Nan beamed. Perhaps the Jedi had made their first friend in the sector.
"Hold on. We'll be back in touch shortly."
She nodded as the visual signal faded out. No pirate attack was imminent. However, a vague feeling tugged at Colmac, a barely conscious sense that something important remained undiscovered.
"Captain Jossie," he said, "can you expand your scanner perimeters?"
Leox nodded.
"Just so long as you know when we gain reach, we lose clarity. As with so much in life."
"Unacceptable trade."
Colmac leaned closer to analyze any scraps of information they might receive. Instead of scraps, the screen suddenly filled with data. Leox's eyes widened as he scrolled in closer.
"Whoa, whoa, whoa! What the heck have we got here?"
"A space station?" Wraith said, making the leap faster than Colmac would have guessed.
"But it's nowhere near the system's star, and the energy levels are low. doesn't look like anybody's aboard,
Affy said while bent over her own readings.
Though at this distance, we can't tell for sure.
We've heard nothing from the station despite the unexpected arrival of 11 ships in this system, Comac said. Energy readouts are fairly low. The likeliest conclusion is that the station's abandoned.
Abandoned?
Wreath asked.
Why? Simply gone derelict? Or has it become dangerous for some reason?
Comac shrugged.
Maybe. Or could be this area was once a prosperous shipping route and now is less so. Or it could simply have gotten old. Regardless, we should search it.
I'll add to that, Leox said. We need to search it soon, as in right around now. And so should every other ship in the area, because the local star isn't happy.
A quick scan showed the danger. The star of that blank, empty system was a volatile one, not yet ready to go supernova, but beginning the final millennia leading up to that cataclysm. As such, it would be prone to solar flares of dangerous scale and intensity. Their readings indicated it was about to flare up, sending out plumes of super-hot matter that would be a million kilometers in length. When that happened, as it would within the day, if not the hour, the individual ships would be at risk of immolation.
We have to put the space station between our ships and the star, Comac said. Obviously, the station has shielding that allows it to endure in this system. If we anchor ourselves on the far side, we have a chance.
Leox nodded.
Sending out the alert right now.
Thank the Force,
Comac thought,
for problems with simpler solutions.
They allowed the illusion that the universe could be controlled, an illusion everyone needed from time to time. For the first time since Master Jorah had told him of their assignment to Starlight Beacon, Wreath felt excited. An abandoned space station seemed likely to offer adventure without bugs, and some stories to tell his friends, whenever he got to see them again. But Wreath wasn't going to think about that just yet. Finally, he could get back to living in the present moment, as a Jedi should. It had been too long. Every second they traveled closer to the station, his fascination grew. The design was one he'd never seen before. Its center was a large sphere made of hexagonal plates of some transparent material. Heavy metal rings clustered on square-shaped tethers at its poles, with another metal ring stretching around its equator, which he estimated at roughly 500 meters in diameter. One airlock was part of the sphere itself, but was unusable, mostly because it was both enormous and highly irregularly shaped, built to welcome some kind of ship none of them had ever seen before, perhaps because it had ceased to exist. Master Comac's theory about the station's abandonment seemed to be accurate, because signs of damage and wear were apparent. Missing panels, a small chunk of one ring broken away. However, its power core must have remained strong, because light still shone from the transparent central globe. Their readings confirmed this as the vessel got closer.
Gravity? Check,
Affy said.
Life systems? Check. Atmospheres and oxygen-hydrogen mix, so we can go on board if we want to.
Wreath wanted to.
How long do you think that place has been abandoned? Decades? Centuries?
More like millennia, to judge by the tech,
Leox said, squinting as he studied the station.
That looks familiar, but I can't place why.
The Amaxians! A thrill of recognition swept through Wreath, bringing a smile to his face as he placed the familiar curved shapes and patterns of the metal. That's Amaxian technology!
Amaxian? Affy wrinkled her nose.
Who are they?
Wreath loved nothing more than a chance to explain.
They were ancient warriors, from really long ago, even before the Republic. Their fierceness in battle was supposedly unmatched. There are all these legends of how their scouts would appear almost out of thin air, signaling the troops to sweep in for attack.
What happened to them?
Affy asked.
Apparently, when the Republic unified so much of the galaxy,
The Amaxines weren't willing to accept the peace, so they left the galaxy and flew into empty space in search of another great war to fight.
Which didn't make sense in Reith's opinion, but he didn't waste time judging a people who died out thousands of years before. Besides, the sheer thrill of this moment, seeing something that had once been only myth and legend suddenly come vividly alive, eclipsed everything else.
Leox drawled, "Now that you mention it, I believe I've heard some stories about the Amaxines, how they took off so long ago. But people have been here way more recently than that."
Frowning, Affy asked, "How do you know?" Reith was glad she had, because that meant he didn't have to.
"Pre-programmed coordinates." Leox thumped the dash. "This system was in our navicomputer. I don't know why, and neither does Geode, and neither do you. Which is why I want you to ask your mama about this as soon as we get back to her. You're the only one who might get a straight answer as to why Bind Guild's ships all come programmed with a map that leads us out of hyperspace straight to here."
Reith turned his head, as though studying the readouts more thoroughly, so he couldn't see Affy's face. The explanation was obvious. Some kind of illegal trade. Maybe something the Guild did on the side. It wouldn't be easy for Affy to hear that, surely. But there were other possibilities. The Guild might monitor illegal trade rather than engage in it, or even work against it in an effort to eliminate corrupt competition. They didn't have enough information to know. For Reith, information had always been as vital as air, something he felt he could never accumulate enough of. However, he was realizing that not knowing everything created a certain exhilaration, which was probably going to be brief and wasn't as good as actually being informed and prepared. Still, he'd take what enjoyment he could get. A red light appeared on the vessel's console, then another, then all of them almost at once glaring scarlet. Every single alert on the ship was sounding. "Uh-oh," Leox said. His usual calm was finally shaken. "We've got a solar flare incoming." Reith stared in the rough direction of the star, but it wasn't visible at that angle. "When?" Affy's face had gone pale.
4 minutes.
Normally, an apprentice was to wait for a master's approval before taking any dramatic action. Nothing about this situation was normal. Reith went for the comms.
"All vessels, approach the station for immediate docking. You have 4 minutes to get on the safe side of the station away from the star. We'll send out boarding orders shortly after we've checked the station out. Just get there now."
Coordinates came up on Leox's panel and he nodded.
"Thanks, Geode, heading in."
The ship shifted so swiftly that gravity didn't have time to compensate, sending Reith sliding to the far side of the bridge. Apparently, the senior Jedi had been caught off guard also, to judge by the thumps and a muttered oof he heard from within the main cabin. Within seconds, the other ships came into view, all of them headed for the one small sliver of safety to be found behind the station, until one, the smallest one, slowed.
"That's Nan's ship, right?"
When Affy nodded, Reith took the comm again.
"Nan, you guys need to hurry."
"Our engine's giving out! We need repairs and there's no time!"
Reith turned toward Leox.
"Does the vessel have a tractor beam?"
"Negatory." Leox wore a thoughtful look.
"What we do have is a tow line."
"Head for Nan's ship," Reith said. Affy shot him a look, and it occurred to him that while the Jedi were ready to risk their lives for others, civilians weren't necessarily as committed. Nor was it fair to expect that of them. People had the right to guard their own survival. Before he could speak, though, she'd already flipped the toggle to ready the tow line, and Leox turned them sharply toward Nan's ship. More thuds sounded from the back, and a harried Orla Jareni appeared in the doorway, bracing herself against the jam.
"What in the seven hells is going on?"
"We're evading a solar flare," Reith said. "Another ship needs help to get to safety."
"Got it."
Orla had instantly snapped out of her mood.
What can I do?
Leox answered her. Solar radiation's about to soak this whole system. For everybody except the Mizzy, that station's the only safe place to be. So we need exosuits at the ready.
Affy chimed in.
And an order of boarding for all the ships, so not everybody's trying to hitch themselves to an airlock at once.
Immediately, Orla got to work. Reith could only hang on and watch as they drew nearer to the pitifully small ship belonging to Nan and her guardian. It looked even more slapdash up close, obviously pieced together from other ship fragments. Like a rainy day craft project for Ugnaughts, Reith thought, then mentally took it back. These people were doing the best they could with what they had. They deserved respect for their ingenuity. He asked,
"How close do we have to get for the tow line?"
"Not too close," Leox said, then proved it by firing the tow. It lanced through empty space before colliding with the hull of Nan's ship. With a shimmer of energy, the electromagnetic clamp kicked in.
"Alrighty. Now we just have to get to the station before being incinerated to atoms."
Reith tried not to let his reaction show, but he must not have done a good job because Affy said,
"Don't scare the landlubbers."
"We've only got 45 seconds left," Leox said, and Affy's jaw dropped.
Apparently the situation was just as scary as Reith had thought. But Leox, and possibly Geode, took them around the curve of the spherical station a full 2 seconds before outer space filled with a flash of brilliant white light. Reith shielded his eyes with his arm and was still nearly blinded for a moment. When he could sort of see again, he said,
"That means we made it, right?"
Leox put his hands behind his head. "Am I good or what?"
Before anyone could board the station, a landing party had to make certain the interior was safe. Dez had asked to lead the way. Affy agreed to go on behalf of the vessel crew. Reith volunteered readily, though he had questions.
"Should we conduct more scans first? There could be dimensions to this station we don't understand. Risks we haven't guessed."
"That's why they call it adventure."
Dez was already double-checking settings on his wristband equipment, pacing near the airlock.
"We already checked the atmosphere, so we know we can breathe. Anything else, we'll handle as it comes."
As Leox carefully maneuvered the vessel into docking position on the central ring, Reith asked Affy,
"Have you explored lots of abandoned old places? Are there tons of things like this out here?"
"First time," she said brightly, like there was zero chance they were about to die.
Maybe that was true.
"Look at it this way," he told himself. "You're doing research with primary sources, getting the information straight from the source to share with others later."
It helped, thinking that the last phase of this task would be simply writing it all down. Their airlock spun open. Light streamed in, almost blinding at first, and Reith momentarily feared another solar flare. His eyes must have adjusted to the light more slowly than Dez's, because he whispered,
"Would you look at that?"
An instant later, Reith could see it too. A tunnel leading from the boxy utilitarian ring straight into the central globe of the station itself. As the three of them walked through the tunnel, he realized it was transparent, creating the illusion that they were suspended in the blackness of space. He'd never experienced anything like it, strolling through a sea of stars. Vertigo threatened him for a moment, but it soon vanished in sheer fascination. Reith was drawn by both the spectacular view around him and what he saw ahead. An abundance of green. They emerged into the central globe, which included booths and kiosks on multiple layers of walkways. They might have once been shops, laboratories, all open to the glassy sphere that formed the body of the station, and all covered in vines, and ferns, and moss, even a couple of trees. Plant life spilled over every beam, climbed up every wall. This was more flora than Reith saw in a year on Coruscant.
How? Wreath murmured as they stepped out, stems crunching beneath their feet. How is this possible? Dez gestured toward the blazing light at the core, a small array of supercharged hexagonal power banks suspended in energy fields. Self-generating light and heat, fueling the station. The plants took care of the rest themselves. It's beautiful. Affy breathed, walking forward with her face turned up to the light. Wreath couldn't disagree. Instead of something menacing and diabolical, he'd strolled into an orbiting garden. I bet the station had an arboretum, he mused as they walked forward. To supply oxygen and food and help travelers relax, all those things. And after the station was abandoned, the plants took it over. Sounds about right to me, Dez said, then inhaled deeply and smiled. The air was not only breathable, but also smelled wonderful, fresh, sweet. Look there. Turns out the plants have had some help. Following Dez's pointing finger, Wreath glimpsed movement within the greenery. A small droid emerged, an antique 8T gardening model which looked a lot like the head dome of an astromech let loose on its own. The thin metal instruments protruding from one of its panels appeared to be busy pollinating some bell-shaped flowers in shades of orange and violet. Another 8T appeared, closer by, busy at the same task. They took no notice of intruders. Their programming was solely about taking care of plants. It appeared the droids had done their job admirably. Should we do a botanical survey? Wreath asked. Catalog all the life forms here, find out if any are unknown to us at present?
That's droid work, Dez said. And not particularly urgent. Personally, I'd like to get a better look at the other things sentience left behind. Starting with that.
He gestured toward a particularly thick patch of fronds, revealing a shape that had been almost obscured behind them. A statue of a figure, human or at least humanoid, carved of some kind of stone and gilded with something dully golden that reflected the light. The vaguely feminine figure wore an elaborately carved headdress set with either colored glass or actual jewels, and it held its arms crossed over its chest. It resembled no mythological deity or folkloric hero Wreath knew of, but he felt a thrill anyway. This was a window into history, into legend. But behind that thrill lurked a shiver, a shadow. Staring at the statue, he said, "Do you feel that?" "Yes," Dez said. His voice had grown more thoughtful. "The shadow. It might not mean anything. Or it might," Wreath couldn't help thinking. Affy Hollow neither understood what shadow Dez and Wreath were talking about, which made no sense since they were all bathed in light, nor cared. Whatever mysticism this brand of wizard monk peddled was only mildly interesting to her. The station, however, was fascinating. Not because of the antiquities the Jedi were already fawning over. Because of objects far more recent than that. Affy's sharp eyes picked out the spanner first, then the Ankh. A handful of spacer's tools, strewn in one corner, obviously abandoned for a while, but not long enough for any vines to grow over them. The moss beneath them still seemed healthy and green, so they couldn't have been there longer than a few months, a couple of years. She wasn't exactly an expert on moss. Maybe Geode would know. However, she was certain that it hadn't been very long since other travelers had come through the station. Probably some of them had been Bind Guild pilots. Why else would the system's coordinates be pre-programmed into the vessel's computer? Definitely nothing else remotely interesting was to be found around there. Even by the standards of open space, that area was bleak. So this station had to have been of some use to the Guild, sometime, or it wouldn't have been one of the places in their navicomputer. Hundreds of places, she reminded herself. Maybe even thousands. We never counted them all. What's the point? Some of that data might be old, out of use.
obsolete to how the Guild runs today. Scover built everything off pre-existing Navicomputers back when she was first creating the Guild. Then she remembered that Scover might at that moment be dead or injured because of a disaster far larger than anything they'd ever encountered before, and her heart ached anew. For the Jedi, this disaster was of great but abstract concern. For her, it was intensely personal. Remembering how hard her foster mother had worked to build her shipping fleet made Affy even more fiercely hopeful that Scover had lived. She deserved to live, to reap the benefits of all that effort. But the others killed in the disaster had probably deserved to live too. Chance was too cruel to pay attention to what people deserved. Dez was studying the inscription on the sandstone statue. Reef asked, "Can you read it?"
"No, it's not written in Orabesh, and the glyph groupings don't look like Mesic," Dez said. "But it's not wholly unfamiliar either. Reminds me of a couple of ancient languages we studied. An actual scholar might be able to translate. Luckily, we've got one on board."
Affy wondered whether she should mention the tools or not. The Jedi didn't seem to care one way or the other about who might have used the station recently, so she decided she'd keep that information to herself for the moment. When she had a chance to talk with Leox or Geode alone, they could discuss this and decide what the Jedi did and didn't need to know. When Comac got his first good look at the small ship approaching them at 1/10 power, he felt a moment of empathy, almost tenderness. It had been literally patched together from at least 4 or 5 other ships, none of which appeared even vaguely similar in design. What poverty must have inspired this? At least desperate need had been matched with determined innovation. Where most would have considered themselves planet-bound and trapped, these people had found their own way to the stars. As soon as they had confirmation that all species aboard could breathe inside the station, Comac indicated that the ragtag ship could dock at the nearest airlock and went out to meet them, Orla at his side. The initial exploration trio returned to stand beside them as the second airlock spun open.
"Oh, look!"
Nan whispered as she walked forward. She was even tinier than she'd appeared on the screen, a girl hardly more than 1.5 meters tall, dressed in a shabby but colorful dress. Her dark hair was vividly painted with blue streaks, a flash of vivacity and life.
"It's like my terrarium, but big enough to walk in."
"Yes, just like your terrarium,"
said the elderly Zabrak, hobbling out after her, chuckling. His clothes were a match for hers, and his walking stick had countless notches carved into it as a record of some measure of a life Comac could hardly imagine.
"Hello there. I'm Heg, and apparently you've met my ward, Nan."
"Comac Vidus, Jedi Knight." He held out his hand to shake, a custom that fortunately seemed to be as familiar on the frontier as at home.
"Welcome. Let me introduce my compatriots, Dez Rydan, Orla Jorenni, Reef Silas, and Affy Hollow. We hope to turn this station into a place of refuge for those stranded by the hyperspace closure."
"You're the ones in charge, eh? Good, good. I don't mind saying that we're grateful to see you. Hardly enough provisions on board to last us 3 days. I don't need so much, but the little one..."
"I believe the larger transports will offer adequate food for us all," Comac said. "Assuming they're willing to share and that the hyperspace lanes aren't closed for too long. No point in worrying these people about it. For now, get yourselves settled."
Orla nodded her greetings, but moved past Comac, back into the vessel for reasons of her own. The travelers weren't offended by her departure. Nan in particular looked delighted to have found people her own age. No wonder. Comac wasn't familiar with Zabrak lifespans, but Haig was at a minimum several decades older. Looking back and forth between Reef and Affy, Nan asked,
"Are you both Jedi Knights too?"
Affy made a sound that Comac decided not to interpret as rude.
"Hardly.
I'm the co-pilot on the vessel. I will be a Jedi Knight someday, Wreath said. But for now, I'm still a Padawan, a student in the ways of the Force. Nan lit up.
I've heard tales of the Jedi. Can you tell me more about your order? How you learn to do the things you do?
Curiosity about the Jedi was great in the frontier region, in ways both good and bad. Komak hoped they would make a good impression starting from this moment on. However, he suspected Nan's interest had as much to do with Wreath's pleasant face as it did with the Jedi. Probably far more. As older Jedi always did when observing such interactions between younger ones and outsiders to the Order, Komak mused, I fear someone will have to break it to her that the Jedi don't... Well, let Wreath deal with that, if and when it arose. Orla came to his side.
Listen, I know you have plenty to think about at the moment. Leading the group, organizing the refugees as they come on board...
Your point? Komak asked. Orla arched an eyebrow so sharply it could have cut.
My point is, you can delegate your other roles. You can't delegate your knowledge of ancient artifacts. Dez has pointed out that this place is chock full of ancient tech and even more ancient statues. With inscriptions. In unknown languages?
Orla pronounced all this in the same tone of voice she might have told a racing enthusiast about the neutrino angler in the hangar next door, or described holiday sweets to an excited child. Even though Komak was usually more moderate in his enthusiasms, Orla had caught his attention.
Totally unknown languages?
One of them, at least, reminds Dez a little bit of old Alderaanian. He could be wrong, though. An expert's eyes would see much more.
Then I leave it to Dez and Wreath to handle the station boarding for now.
He put one hand on Orla's shoulder.
Lead the way.
After they had walked several steps away, Orla said more quietly,
It threw me at first. An accident in this area of space. A ship we didn't know well.
I thought of it too,
Komak replied. This chapter of his past was one he rarely reflected on. The parallels between this mission and the first one he and Orla had undertaken together, he'd hoped to put them aside and ignore them for the duration of the disaster. Apparently, Orla didn't intend to let him. He should have expected no less. Komak could practically see the words hovering on her lips. However, before she could delve into the subject, she halted in her tracks and said,
Do you feel that? The shadow? The chill? Wreath and Dez sensed it as well.
It's darkness,
Komak said.
I felt it too. Something on this station is bound to the dark side.
Some people were awestruck by Jedi, unable to relate to them. Others could be hostile. Afraid of what they didn't understand, afraid of power they couldn't possess. Sheltered as he'd been within the temple, Wraith often wasn't sure how to bridge the gap and connect with regular people as, well, people. With Nan, there was no gap at all.
Are the Jedi soldiers sworn to the Republic?
She glanced down shyly as they stood beneath the canopy of leaves that sheltered the station docks.
Or do you fight only for yourselves?
Wreath shook his head.
Neither. I mean, we defend the Republic, but we work with them, not for them. And that's not all we do. We try to help and protect all those in need when we can.
This didn't seem to make sense to Nan.
Do you accept payment?
We're not mercenaries. He had to laugh.
Is it so unimaginable that a group of people might try to do the right thing just because it is the right thing?
It is around here,
she said, her expression grim. Despite her youth, Nan had evidently witnessed some terrible things.
What's that at your belt? Is it the sword we've heard of? The fire saber?
He grinned. It's called a lightsaber, and yeah, this one's mine.
Will you light it?
Nan asked, anticipation sparkling in her dark eyes.
Not unless I have a good reason. It wasn't forbidden, but if he did that, he'd draw too much attention. Master Comac might even think they were flirting. Actually, Reef thought Nan probably was flirting, but he was just explaining.
Please?
Nan's expression could have melted ice.
I'd love to know how it works.
Before Reef could figure out how vulnerable he might be to that expression, Leox's voice came over the comms.
The final ships are boarding all passengers to the station. You guys ready out there?
Absolutely, Reef said. The moment was broken. He could focus on his duty again. Come on, Nan. Let's greet the guests. She made a face.
Mizzy? Arinkens? You can call them whatever you want, but they're not going to act like guests.
What will they act like? Reef asked. Nan had a mischievous smile.
Wait and see.
Good thing the bracing joints held on this station, thought Affy Hollow as she made her way along the walkway through a tangle of vines. Otherwise, this thing would have imploded, and who knows where we'd have wound up. Somewhere else, pre-programmed into the computer, some other location Scover had downloaded, not knowing what traps might have been set for her in old Navicomputers. Affy had chosen to wander upward, along the lone spiral walkway that traveled along the central globe of the Amaxine Station, leading toward the topmost rings. From her vantage point, she could survey the layout almost completely. Outer ring, several metal arches separating the various segments, each of which had an airlock of its own. Central sphere, several enclosures set up along the walkway, but otherwise completely an arboretum. She would have thought it was always intended to be one if it weren't for the fact that the Amaxines had built this. The legends suggested they weren't the tranquil gardener type. Through the transparent plates, she could see some of the other ships coming in to dock.
They put the Arinkan ship next to the Mizzy?
Oh, that's going to be a huge mess. These Jedi might be brilliant monk wizards, but they were also completely uninformed about this part of the galaxy, especially which species within it hated each other. As she passed the one large irregular airlock in the sphere, Affy was tempted to head back to the bridge to help Leox and Geode sort through the resulting squabbles, and to witness the poleaxed expressions on the Jedi's faces. She didn't dislike any of the Republic types, actually, but it was very obvious how much they thought they were the ones bringing wisdom and knowledge. About time they learned better. But while plenty of the ships would be crewed by beings that loathed each other, none of them seemed likely to make war. It would be a mess, not a disaster. Probably. So that meant Affy was free to explore on her own. Lower rings? She still didn't know. Upper rings? Affy looked up. By then she was within meters of the tunnel that would lead up and out. Time to discover just what else this station had to offer. From one corridor, she heard Orla Jareni and Comac Vitus saying something indistinct, no doubt about the antiquities that seemed to practically litter the decks. They'd be distracted by that for a while and would pay no attention to where Affy went or what she did. This was ideal. She pushed aside a curtain of vines and made her way into the tunnel that led upward. Gravity adjusted with her as she went, an unusual and ingenious modification. Apparently, all those ancient station mechanisms remained in perfect working order. Affy had no intention of touching anything inside, because any tech so old that was still running would be best left alone. Any other space traveler would know that too. Other space travelers would also know that the top and bottom rings were the likeliest places for storage bays, and for the cargo others had left behind. If she was any judge, this station's storage was at the top. Sure enough, as Affy stepped from the tunnel into the shadowy topmost rings, she could make out long lines of storage bays, some locker-sized, some bigger, stretching into the central dark. Larger storage might be located on the lower rings, The larger bays could hold potentially dangerous substances, so she'd go through those later, maybe with Leox's help. For now, she would just rummage around. Then she cocked her head. Was there writing on the lockers? Affy turned on her glow rod as she crept forward. Across the lockers and other bay doors were scrawled some symbols, not labeling but actual handwriting or painting, with the same kind of grease pencil pilots use to mark wires for repair. Affy had never handwritten anything in her life, which was hardly unique. Probably she'd never even met someone who wrote something down. Nor was this writing Orabesh. It was symbols, little pictures instead of letters. Different lines were written at different heights in different styles. Then she spotted at the very ends of the lines much smaller numbers. Dates, Affy realized. Those are dates that tells us when they were here. As she'd suspected, it hadn't been that long before. One line was from just 6 years back. Another was from earlier, but still only about 32 years prior. All the writing seemed to come from the recent era, a very long time after this station would have been abandoned. There was no making sense of the lines without knowing their language, or, more likely, their code. The pictographs were fairly crude. Affy ran one finger beneath a line drawing of a crested wave with a diagonal streak through it that looked like the readouts that indicated a gravitational disturbance. And there was one shaped like a Y that suggested a potential fork in the hyperspace lanes or some other diversion. She began to smile as she realized that this was a place where wayfarers left messages for each other, warnings about the path ahead. But why leave important messages in code? Why not make them easy for everyone to read? Affy kept picking out new symbols, trying to guess what each might mean, trailing her finger beneath each line. Then her finger came to a stop, and her smile faded. This symbol was a four-pointed star, a distinctive, stylized one, a symbol Affy knew by heart, which was fitting, because she wore it over her heart every day she wore her uniform coverall. It was the crest of the Bine Guild.
It's muggy in here, Orla said. Almost steamy. Gotta give the biome credit. The best seeded arboretums rarely last anything close to this long. This one not only survived, it's got humidity.
Lucky us, Comac said wryly. They stood in the central sphere within what Orla could see had been a kind of ceremonial area, one marked with a stone-carved seat, or perhaps a throne. A total of four statues stood guard. Each one depicted a different species, or perhaps mythological figure, but they all shared the golden plating and the richly jeweled ornamentation. Vines slithered along the nearby trees and archways. Not literally, though the constant rustling encouraged that illusion. The light was dappled with the shadows of leaves. Those shadows played on Comac's face as he stepped closer to one of the statues, peering up at the finely carved wings and carapace.
Do you recognize it?
Orla asked. Comac shook his head.
The style of carving is not unlike the ancient Kubas. But that system is so distant, my first assumption would be that the similarity is a coincidence. Furthermore, the Kubas don't have any insect gods, so far as I know.
Orla put her hands on her hips. Maybe they're not gods. Maybe they're monarchs or historical leaders.
Monarchs, perhaps, Comac said. But I doubt they're historical figures. The way they're elevated over the viewers, the grandiose halos over their heads. See, there are spaces that probably held even larger jewels once upon a time. To me, that suggests profound reverence, the deepest respect and adoration. In the long run, history isn't that kind to anybody, but religions are, myths are. There could be other meanings, too.
Until we translate this language, I can't offer anything more than an educated guess. Gods would be my bet.
A soft breeze tugged at the edge of Comac's robes, played across Orla's cheek. At first, Orla simply welcomed that faint touch of coolness. Then she thought, guess that's why the vines are rustling. This station has even better ventilation than I'd realized.
Then Orla felt a delicate shiver of unease, an eerie sensation that only grew with each moment. Comac turned to her.
There it is. The shadow. The darkness.
They stood still for a few moments. We've all felt it now, Orla said. I might have assumed it was no more than a rogue tree. Plants can sometimes be strong in the dark side. But this...
it's different,
Comac finished for her. It feels deliberate.
Orla breathed in and out, tried to center herself in the force, but such calm was elusive. By then, the darkness was more than a shiver, almost a presence, as if something or someone was slowly approaching them. Orla wondered if that could be true. Had a being hidden on this station? Was it not as abandoned as they had supposed?
I'm checking the corridor, Orla said, hurrying toward the door. From the corner of her eye, she saw Comac nodding. He'd sensed the same thing. And then Orla was alone in the howling dark. She dropped into a crouch before the gale force winds could knock her down. Cold chilled her to the marrow, and sharp flecks of debris scratched at her skin. Terror clawed at her belly, threatening to drag her into darkness too. Orla called on the Force to sustain her. Even if she could no longer sense it, the Force was always there.
Comac!
She shouted, not knowing why.
Comac! Where are you?
Shards of metal and mineral dug into her hands as she pushed herself up, trying to look around. In the distance, she could make out only collapsed beams of metal, and through them an ominous glow. Though it was the brightest light she could see, it filled her with nothing but horror. No more cold. No more darkness. Orla opened her eyes. When had she closed them? To find herself in the arboretum, near the door, just where she'd been a few seconds before when the universe made sense.
Comac!
She called, but heard no answer. Rising back to her feet, she saw him lying among the moss and vines on the floor, either unconscious or in trance, as though prostrate before an unknown god. Orla hurried to his side, and just as she knelt by Comac's shoulder, his dark eyes flew open. But his breaths were coming short and shallow, and he stared upward at Orla without seeming to truly see.
"We have to get back to the ship," Orla said gently, unsure whether Comac could even hear her.
Let me put my arm beneath your shoulders.
That wasn't just a vision.
Comac blinked, then looked up at Orla with complete clarity.
It was a warning.
Reith had thought they were getting to the easy part. Everybody was safe. Everybody needed to share space for a while, so they'd all try to get along, right? He'd been so wrong. The first pilots to emerge were humans who looked rough and wanted you to know it.
This place is abandoned, huh?
One of them said, stalking right past Reith's hand outstretched in welcome.
That makes everything on board fair game.
Wait, Reith began. Everyone should get a chance at the resources they need.
Not if they're mine.
The guy tugged at the red kerchief around his neck as he smirked at Reith.
Anything that's not bolted down is mine. Anything I can pull loose isn't bolted down. Come on, men. Let's start hunting.
They stalked through the rings, looking for lockers and other storage. Before Reith could decide whether to go after them, another group emerged. These were the Arinkans, who appeared to be related to the Gamorreans, only paler and less photogenic. Their captain squealed in outrage at the sight of the humans already plundering the ring, then took off after them. Reith first went for his comlink.
Master Comac, we're dealing with some, unrest among the refugees.
If you could come, that would be a big help.
No answer came. Wreath drew on the Force, summoned his will, and called out,
"You want to stop looting the station and return to this place?"
Nobody listened.
He breathed out in frustration.
Master Jorah was so good at bending people's will with the Force, but it was more an innate skill than one easily taught.
Wreath might get the knack of it someday, but that wouldn't do any good in the here and now. Reluctantly, Wreath pulled out his lightsaber. Time to lay down the law, which he'd never laid down before, but he'd figure it out.
Well, pay me purple and call me Barney. That was a good part of Into the Dark. The High Republic is turning out better than imagined, from facing down the Nihil to teaming up with heroes that make us want to be braver. So far, it's been one heck of a journey. And the secrets? Man, we heard stuff that could flip the whole galaxy upside down. But I think this is a good time to get to the quote. And it comes to us from Samuel Lockwell. He said, "Great works are performed not by strength, but by perseverance." Okay, let's break this quote down. Picture this. You're looking at two people trying to open a really tight jar lid. One relies on being super strong, trying to twist it open with brute force. The other might not be as strong, but keeps trying different methods, like tapping the lid, using a cloth for better grip, or running the lid under hot water. The jar eventually opens, not because of sheer muscle, but because the second person's willingness to keep trying, to not give up. That's what this quote is all about. The biggest achievement, or the coolest things that you accomplish, aren't just about how strong, smart, or talented you are. It's more about your grit, your stick-to-itiveness, or your ability to hang in there and keep going even when things get tough. Let's say you want to build a really cool project, like a giant model airplane, or start your own business selling something you made. You might not have all the knowledge or skills right off the bat. If you rely on only what you know and how skilled you are at the start, you might hit a wall and give up. But if you are willing to learn and try and fail and try again, you're practicing perseverance. You're showing that you are willing to push through the challenges and learn from them. In real life, this looks like setting a goal and sticking with it, no matter how many times you might mess up or face setbacks. It's about waking up each day and putting in a little hard work towards your dream, learning from your mistakes and not getting discouraged by them. This perseverance, this never give up attitude, is what leads to achieving great things. That's the real secret behind accomplishing something amazing. And I think that's where we'll wrap up episode 3. Thanks for joining me on this part of our Star Wars journey. I'm pumped to see how our heroes keep going and growing in our next episode, coming your way in a few days. So until then, may the Force be with you. Thank you for listening to Star Wars Audio Archives. Join us next time for more Star Wars adventures. If you would like to listen to other episodes of the show, you can follow us on your favorite podcast directory. If you enjoyed the show, we would greatly appreciate a 5-star review. Once again, thank you for listening, and may the Force be with you. Sway was created by Kenai Shedd and is a production of Pick Film Media. This show was produced by Quinn McDaniel and was distributed by Sway Cast Network. Star Wars was read to you by Jason Odega. Sound designed by Theodore Thompson. I am your host, Kyle, and we will see you next time in a galaxy far, far away.